My name is Chris O'Leary, and these are the Sins of the Fathers. Episode 1, That Day. I'm a survivor of abuse by a Catholic priest. I was sexually exploited, abused, and assaulted, and worse. My abuser's name was Father Leroy Valentine, and my abuse occurred at Immaculata in Richmond Heights, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis, and my abuse took place from basically the fall of 1977 to the winter of 1980 and 81, at least. In terms of my testimony, my plan, my initial plan was to get help from the Archdiocese and, you know, go through the process and just get help and, you know, just get help quietly, and that was it. But it turns out that plan didn't work. So then in October of 2015, I was forced to sue the Archdiocese of St. Louis and was going to give this testimony, was planning on giving this testimony to a jury. However, because of a problem with the statute of limitations that was created by the Archdiocese of St. Louis, that didn't happen. And I was forced to settle for a net to me of $9,000 in September 2017. So while my plan was to basically just take the money and run, to just, you know, hide on a farm and never interact with people, it seems that wasn't the plan. So I'm still trying to figure out what the plan is, what God's plan is, but I think part of the plan is telling my story to let people know exactly what life is like for survivors. I'm gonna give you as detailed an overview as I can. I'm for legal reasons, I have to leave out a few things, mostly because the Archdiocese of St. Louis has told a number of lies, and I'm not sure that they actually know what lies they've told. I've interacted with so many people and they've told so many lies that I'm leaving out a few things so that, that the, Attorney General of the state of Missouri and his investigation team, can figure out, can see that the Archdiocese has been lying and figure out what those lies are, and hopefully get a sense of just how horrible and despicable the Archdiocese of St. Louis is. In terms of why should you believe me, that's a reasonable question, especially given the statement by Gabe Jones, a spokesman for the Archdiocese of St. Louis, that he gave in April of 2018 as part of Aisha Sultan's piece in which I Came Forward came out and described some of the abuse that I experienced. As Gabe Jones said, the Archdiocese record of Mr. O'Leary's allegations are significantly different. However, due to a court order, as well as our own ethical obligation, we are not at liberty to discuss Mr. O'Leary's case. Jones also said the information O'Leary shared initially changed multiple times by the time he broke off communication with the Office of Child and Youth Protection. Now, there's a lot of BS in that, and I'll go into it at some point, but I can understand why people, including the people in my parish who are currently basically shunning me, would just assume that I'm lying. As Jones said, the information O'Leary shared initially changed multiple times. It sounds like I'm lying. But the question I would ask you to consider, and that I would ask the Archdiocese of St. Louis, is this: from when to when? And I'll explain why that's a relevant question in the next episode, episode 2. In terms of why you should believe me, here's a simple reason. In February of 2018, February 5th, in fact, of 2018, Sandra Price, the director of Office of Child and Youth Protection of the Archdiocese of St. Louis, sent me the following email in response to an email that I sent her or CC'd her on. Her email reply reads to me as follows. Hi, Chris. I wanted to respond to you on behalf of the Archdiocese of St. Louis. You chose to litigate your claims of sexual abuse by Reverend Leroy Valentine. Your claims were acknowledged by Deacon Phil Hangen, the Archdiocese of St. Louis, and the court system. The matter has been fully settled through litigation and is final. Because your claim has been fully settled and is final, the Archdiocese of St. Louis will not be responding to any further inquiries regarding these claims. Please know that you and all victims of abuse are in my prayers, and I do hope that you are able to find peace in the future. I wish you the best, Sandra Price, Archdiocese of St. Louis. Now, there's, as with the Gabe Jones piece, there are a number of lies in there, but and I'll discuss those at some point later, maybe probably in the next episode, but the essential truth is this. On February 5th, 2018, Sandra Price, the director of the Archdiocese of St. Louis Office of Child and Youth Protection, told me in an email, your claims were acknowledged, and you and all victims of abuse are in my prayers. So, in other words, Sandra Price of the Archdiocese of St. Louis on February 5th, 2018, acknowledged that it happened. She did so in a, buried amongst a bunch of lies, and in a way that it actually took me literally 10 days to understand what she was saying, that she was admitting that it happened, but she was admitting that it happened. She admitted that it happened. Your claims were acknowledged. You and all victims of abuse are in my prayers. So that's why I hope you would believe me. Now let's go on to my story. And before, my story starts with a lot of dealing with what I'm dealing with when I'm talking about our memories. So let's talk for a second about repressed memory. Why can it take so long to come forward? In my case, it took so long for me to come forward because of the repressed memory scandals of the 90s and the early 2000s or so. And essentially, that changed the standards for which psychologists can deal with memories and repressed memories and trauma and those kinds of things. And essentially, well, here's the fact. I talked to two different psychologists, and over the course of those sessions, with respect to my abuse, they asked me at most maybe one or two questions each over the course of 3 years. It was obvious to me, or it became obvious to me, that they were being very, very, very careful to not plant any thoughts or ideas in my head. They didn't suggest anything. They didn't say anything. The only question my second psychologist asked was, how old do you feel at the moment, when I was relaying a memory to her? But it seems like the psychological profession has taken the repressed memory fiasco very seriously, and they are very careful when it comes to dealing with survivors of trauma and abuse to make sure that people are not asked leading questions. And that was very much the case, in my situation, and I completely understand it. But you need to understand that one reason why it takes so long for abuse survivors to come forward is that we have to drive the whole process, and we have to remember everything on our own. And it literally took me 5 years or so to be able to understand this stuff, to understand what was relevant, because of the abuse and the results of that. And trauma is a real, real problem. And the things it can do to memory, the way it can chop things up, are really problematic in and of themselves. Plus, to require the survivor to have to figure out all the pieces and how they fit together is completely understandable, but it takes a long time. And that's one answer to the question of why does it take so long for survivors to come forward. Now let's talk about my experience at Immaculata. My first memory of a priest is from third grade religion class. And the priest was actually a father, then Bishop, now Cardinal Timothy Dolan, of New York. But I remember Father Dolan in third grade religion class giving us a lesson on, I think it's from Mark, where Jesus heals a blind man, but he actually does so in two steps. The first time he does it, the person can only see sticks, and then Jesus has to redo it. And I remember acting that out, and Father Dolan, I think it must have been, that story must have been told during the Mass earlier during the day that we went to. And at the time, we went to Mass every day but Saturday, basically. We had a Mass before school every day. But I remember, vividly remember, Father Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan, giving us that lesson. And that's the first memory that I have of a priest. A year or so later, in the fall of 1977, another young priest joined the parish, and his name was Father Leroy Valentine. Father Valentine, Father V is what we called him. And I immediately gravitated to him because he was just warm and he was huggy, and it all started with a hug. He was a very warm man who loved to hug kids, and he loved kids, and he loved to be around us and everything. So then we went to confession, I don't know if it was once a semester or once a month, but it was a number of times during the year. And I remember at the same time they introduced this concept called face-to-face confession. I believe this was the fall of 77. So face-to-face confession was, instead of the scary confessionals, which are dark and, with the sliding little plate, which I did, but I didn't like, face-to-face confession was just you and the priest in a room with two chairs, and you're just facing each other, and you just kind of confessed your sins that way. And that was much less intimidating for me, and much more, it just felt like a much better, less scary process. The only problem was that when I would go to face-to-face confession with Father Valentine, he would inevitably give me hugs at the end of confession. And those hugs would go on longer and longer. Each time that I would see him and would go to confession with him, he would hug me for a longer and longer time, and the hugs would linger, and it bothered me to a degree. The word I used when I talked to the Archdiocese was ambivalent. On one hand, I liked the attention, especially because my dad was going through a phase where he thought that you shouldn't hug boys. It was some stupid thing that he read. But so he was going through this not hugging phase, and I guess I was craving attention, so I gravitated towards Father Valentine because he was very much a hugger. But the problem was is that over time, my head would end up in inappropriate positions, particularly his crotch. And I have memories of, like a silver belt buckle, just staring into a silver belt buckle, and the hugs would go on for a longer and long period of time. But so the gist is that it all started with a hug. And it's one thing you should take away from this is the problem with hugging, and probably it sounds like the problem with face-to-face confession to this day. I know at my old parish, they have a barrier between the priest and the person doing the confession, so that theoretically prevents things like hugs. But from what I understand, the practice of just putting two chairs in a room is still common, especially for children. And that terrifies me, because that's exactly how this whole thing started. The whole act of grooming started. The next memory that I have is from the fall of 1977, and it was, I call it risk night. It may have, it was probably sold under the name of youth group or something like that, but essentially Father Valentine, in probably late October, early November 1977, had a party for four of us where we would go over and have pizza and drink real Coke, not Vess or RC, and play board games. And I wasn't the only person who was there. There were, I believe, two or three other guys there. R, A, and T were also there that night. And I have very clear memories of playing Risk in the kitchen table of the rectory facing north, and making a joke with people. But the interesting thing is that there's someone directly ahead of me and there's someone to my right, but the chair to the left of me is empty. And my sense is that that person was with Father Ballantyne. At the time that we were playing Risk in the rectory, that fourth person was with Father Ballantyne. And I have a separate memory of being with Father Ballantyne and watching TV on a sofa in the rectory. And it was an old, you know, like pedestal furniture style TV, and being on the sofa and laying down with him and those kinds of things. I also have another memory of wrestling. I don't know if it happened that time or it was a separate time, but the gist of the wrestling memory was he was obsessed with wrestling and he really wanted to teach us how to wrestle. And during those wrestling sessions, it was mostly the boys wrestling with each other. But if we would do something wrong, Father Ballantyne would show us the right way to do a move, especially if you're trying to flip someone. And when we were trying to flip someone, we would grab them up by the knee. But what Father Ballantyne wanted us to do was to grab the person down by the crotch. Now, maybe that's good technique. I don't know. I don't know anything about wrestling. I have no interest in wrestling as a result of that. But I mean, yes, I guess theoretically it's easier to flip to someone when you grab them down by the crotch rather than up by the knee. But the fact was that when Father Ballantyne would demonstrate that move to us, his hand would slip. And he would actually end up touching us down there. And it happened enough that, in retrospect, it doesn't seem like that was an accident. And that actually affected me later on in life. I have problems with intimacy as a result of that, the way that he would touch us and the way it would make me feel then and in the present. And one reason I talk about that is not just because, you know, it was me there, or it was me as well as a number of other people, and I think there are three other people who probably remember that night, because it was a big deal, it was a privilege, it was youth group, it was Father Ballantyne, he was awesome, we got to eat pizza, we got to drink real Coke instead of, you know, Vess or RC. But ever since, I've had problems with board games, where board games are a trigger for me, and I get very, very uncomfortable. And I've actually had problems over my life where I've tried to play board games with people and have had some really bizarre behaviors, which I guess were, you know, regressions or dissociative episodes. And the bigger problem is, you know, I haven't worked for someone else since 2007. And one of the, you know, people are constantly telling me, get a job, get a job, get a job. Why don't you get a job? And part of the problem is it goes back to that night, the Risk night. I remember vividly how excited I was that night. I remember getting out of the car and sprinting into the rectory because it was just going to be this amazing experience, and it was this privilege, and it was so cool to be able to ask to do that, to be asked to do that by Father Ballantyne, and Father Ballantyne was just the coolest. The problem is that because of what happened that night and other nights, excitement for me is a trigger, and joy and anticipation for me are triggers, where I have real problems and can be sent into a deep depression and other things as a result of getting excited. And that caused problems in my marriage and made it maybe weird in terms of, you know, anticipating the birth of children and those kinds of things. But it's very clear to me in retrospect that excitement is a trigger, and that's caused lots of problems in work and in life and in my marriage and other things. So when you tell a survivor of abuse to get a job and you wonder why they can't, maybe the answer is that it's not that easy, that they're dealing with some PTSD, some sort of trigger And they have to deal with that trigger and that PTSD before they're able to do something that seems so simple like getting a job. Another memory that I have, I don't know if I shared this with the Archdiocese or not, but I've always remembered it, was passing out in the presence of Father Valentine. And I would place this probably the winter of 1977. So this would be the winter of fourth grade. And I just remember I was on the ground floor level at the basement of the stairs. There's kind of a T intersection there where there's a classroom. There's the wall of the cafeteria and the stairs. And then on the northeast side is a kind of a multi-purpose rec room with a stage in there. And then on the southeast side is a classroom, I believe. And right at that intersection, there's a T there. And I remember having an episode of passing out. And I remember Father Valentine approaching me from the right or from behind. And I was not a fainter. I never fainted during Mass, with one exception. But, you know, we would do the Easter vigils and Masses that would go on for 2 or 3 hours. And I never had a problem with fainting or diving. And I was very proud of it. But I remember this episode of fainting and of nearly passing out, and then having to sit in a chair and putting my head between my knees. And I remember the association with Father Valentine very clearly. And this is the same time frame as probably a little bit later than that risk party. So I assume and wonder if there's some connection. I assume there's some connection there. That it was the result of perhaps something that happened at that Mass or at some other event. I don't think I would have been serving at that time. I don't think we started serving until you were in fifth grade, so I was just in fourth grade. So this was probably associated with some youth group event, something like that. Another memory that I have, and I actually talked about this with the Archdiocese, and I actually mentioned it when I filed my lawsuit in a press release associated with that, is what I call special training, where at least once, and I believe a number of times during the summer, I think especially when my parents were out of town, they'd go out of town for 4th of July for a convention, Father Valentine would give me what I recall as, the gist of it was special training, where it would just be him and me. Normally there'd be two or three guys who would serve a Mass. And this would be the old people's Mass during the middle of the week. I think it was at 9 o'clock or so, 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning during the summer. But it always worked out that on these special training days, it was just Father Valentine and me. And from a child protection thing, it should never be just a server and the priest. That's a bad thing for reasons that will soon become obvious. But so the way it would always work out is it would be Father Valentine and me, and I would serve the Mass for him and things would go great. And then afterwards, he would show me things that he shouldn't be showing me back in the sacristy, on the priest side of the sacristy, and I remember the most vivid memory that I have is standing on a counter next to a counter against the wall that divides the priest side and the server side of the sacristy, with the connecting door just to my left. And he was showing me how to refill the hosts into the containers, the gold containers that held the unconsecrated hosts. And we would, so you'd get a, there'd be a, it was like a tube, a clear plastic, crinkly 5-6 inch tube full of hosts. And you would take that out of the counter, one of the overhead cabinets that was on the left, and then you'd kind of very carefully pour the unconsecrated hosts into the bowl and then put the top on so that they could then be used during the Mass for the next day. And I remember that when he was showing me that I would be standing next to the counter and Father Valentine would be behind me, kind of making sure that he would kind of be guiding my hands and showing me what to do. But at some point his hands would get off of my hands and my arms and they would just kind of drop, and he would end up, his hands would end up down there, and stuff would happen. Bad stuff. Stuff that I still kind of reenact to this day compulsively. It's difficult to talk about this stuff, but I have this kind of memory associated with that. I remember when I first started serving, the priest side of the sacristy was no big deal. And then at some point it became a big deal to the point where I didn't like to go back in there. And I remember noticing when I would serve with T or with D, how effortlessly and easily they would walk through the priest side of the sacristy in order to get things. And I was never, from some point on, fifth grade, sixth grade on, it became very difficult for me to walk through the priest side of the sacristy. I didn't like it at all. I would only do it when I had to the point where, you know, there was a little table inside, just inside the door on the priest side of the sacristy. And instead of walking the 20 feet from the server side to that little table and then out to the stage right of the altar, I would instead walk all the way around and in front of the altar. You know, I'd walk 150 feet rather than having to walk 20 feet. And I remember being struck at how easily other people could just walk that 20 or 30 feet through the priest side of the sacristy and how difficult it was for me. That really stood out for me. I didn't understand it at the time, but it really is associated with a darkness and a really, really negative feeling associated with the priest side of the sacristy that I believe goes back to the special training that I've talked about and what happened back then. My next memory may seem a little bit random, but it's significant to me because it just stands out. It's just a fragment of a memory. But I remember I was supposed to, in February of 1980, I was supposed to write a report about the Olympics and about a skier named Leonard Stock. And I remember I had a huge problem writing that report. And I believe it was associated with, at the same time, it was associated with my parents being out of town. And I have a problem with being left alone. It was especially pronounced with my parents, but it also was an issue in my marriage where I would get hugely and horribly triggered when I was left alone, either by my parents or by my now ex-wife. It would terrify me. And I believe it's connected to whatever happened during that Leonard Stock. I believe that something happened to me in February of 1980. I think that would be sixth grade. Kind of winter, spring of sixth grade. I believe that something happened to me. It could have been when one of the special training things happened, or it could have been something else. But I had a real, real problem, and it was a real thing about this report in terms of Leonard Stock. And I have this really strong association between that report and the time and the feeling of being abandoned by my parents and Father Valentine and going back to the special training. And I would feel at the time that the special training would happen, I was always, you know, my parents were out of town and they had quote unquote abandoned me right around the 4th of July. And that's when Father Valentine would call. My parents would leave town and Father Valentine would call. And it's like, he always knew when my parents were going out of town. And I think I just had this really strong association and an increasingly strong association and a fear associated with them leaving town and how bad things would happen. Now let's talk about that day. I'm not sure when that day happened. It was probably either the summer of 79 or the summer of 80. I was 11 or 12 years old. I don't want to get into it in too much detail just because I can't. I may talk about it at some point. But I have always remembered that day. Not everything, but I've certainly remembered the moments immediately after. And it could be that there was some, that there was an episode of special training that took place right before that. And this, you know, what I see is different memories may all be the same memory. They just kind of got blown apart. And that's kind of how, that's the way it works for me, is that my memories get totally fragmented, where the, if you've used a nonlinear video editor, the, that one video and audio clip gets chopped up into the separate video and audio pieces, and a lot of the audio gets thrown away, and it's just a feeling, and it's some of it's video, but some of it's just like a flash of memory. But I have very much that sense of, you know, a fragmented memory with respect to that day. And I know Hollywood, when they like to talk about flashbacks and how they happen all the time. But for me, my memory of that day only happened maybe 10 or 15 times over the course of my life. Enough that I remember it as a recurring memory, but not so much that it's like obsessive or something that it never, you know, it never really stood out to me that I was totally obsessed with it. You know, it's just sometimes, you know, you had something that was fun and you remember it 10 or 15 times, you know, as you get older. That's all that was. But essentially the memory of that day, and I've got a separate piece on it on my website, chrisleary.com/sins, where I discuss it, and I've actually got a video piece on that. But basically the memory is being at the door of the rectory, the inside the rectory where it's dark, opening the door, seeing a flash of blue, light blue, sky blue, and I'm obsessed with that color. Then seeing the handle of the screen door, and then running down a tunnel, a black tunnel with the, it's a curved back wall of the church, so, but the edge of the church looks like it's a mile away, and I'm running down that tunnel, and I'm not just running, but I'm really just, I start off just kind of floating, and then at some point my eye level pops up and I'm still floating, and then eventually as I turn the corner and or follow the curve of the church, I come out of the tunnel and my vision widens, and then I'm just kind of running and I end up hiding under a tree. But I've always remembered that, and I never knew what it meant, in part because the memory was so broken up. But I was definitely and clearly and obviously fleeing something. So when people talk about repressed memory, there are some things that I don't remember clearly. During the course of therapy, what I would do is, so that memory picks up with basically me opening the door, getting the flash of blue, and then seeing the handle. During the course of therapy, what I was able to do was kind of walk back that memory and say, okay, so where was I before I got to the door? Well, I was in the basement of the rectory and the lights were off, and I was scared and sitting on the floor and it was cold. And okay, so where was I before that? And I was with Father Valentine, and then we were walking downstairs into the multipurpose room in the basement of the rectory on the west side of the rectory. But, you know, people talk about repressed memory, but I don't need to deal with any repressed memory. I've always remembered that, you know, that act of bailing, of fleeing from the rectory. I didn't know what I was fleeing from, or I didn't know what it meant, but I've always had that memory of that day and ending up hiding under the tree and panting and terrified, and my ass felt like it was on fire. So the next memory that I have, I believe, comes from the back to school mass. And again, we went to mass every single day. I believe that this was in seventh grade, because I felt arrogant like a seventh grader. And any teacher can tell you that seventh graders are the worst, because they're arrogant because they're the biggest of the little kids, but they're not eighth graders who are worried about high school. I just felt like I was a god, which probably means that I felt that I was a seventh grader. But this would probably be early September, right after Labor Day, the first all school mass. And again, yes, it was early September, so it was probably hot, but the Immaculata Church was always cold, and I never had a problem with passing out. You know, I never passed out during any of the Easter vigils or anything, and I remember just how cold it felt walking into the church. So it would really surprise me that I just overheated. What I believed happened, you know, and the air conditioning should have been on all summer. What did happen is, so I was one of the servers, and I was on the stage left eastmost aisle. So the celebrant of the mass would get the center aisle, and then two priests would walk over from the church and cover the left and the right aisles. And I was on the left aisle in the stage left position, which means kind of looking out from the altar into the audience, the congregation. And I remember Father Valentine walking up. So what happens is the servers go there first, and then the priest comes, you know, like 30 seconds later. And I remember Father Valentine walking up and being surprised by it. And essentially what happened was I got progressively more and more, I had like a panic attack, and all the blood drained from my face. And it was obvious enough that our principal and then my old fourth grade teacher, Mrs. M, they saw what was happening to me. They saw the blood and the color drained from my face. And they ended up taking me back into the server side of the rectory. And there was a church up against the west wall, or there was a chair up against the west wall, and I almost passed out. And that's only the second time in my life that I've ever really, you know, come close to passing out. But that was very, very distinctive, and it was very much associated with Father Valentine, and I believe that it was associated with that day. It could have been, you know, a month or two after that day, but he just very much surprised me, and it freaked me out, and it caused a panic attack, and my blood pressure dropped, and all the blood drained out of my head to the point where I almost passed out, and it was visible to the other people in the church. Another memory that I have, and I actually have a picture of this, is a mud cave trip that Father Valentine took me and two other guys, P and A. I think it was December 26, 1980. He took us to a mud cave. I believe that A's dad came with us and ended up taking the picture that I have. That was fun, and it was cool, and that was one of the things. I think a lot of people have memories of Father Valentine taking them to trips to, you know, Mount Tomsock, or, you know, it's just what he did as part of youth group, was he took people on trips. But the specific memory that I have, and I again talked about this with the Archdiocese, is of the car ride back from the mud cave trip. I was sitting in the front passenger seat. Father Valentine was driving, and then the other two guys and A's dad were in the back seat, or even the third row seat. I think it was a white station wagon. The front seat was a bench seat. And the thing that I remember is waking up kind of suddenly, and I was aroused, and I don't know for certain, but I strongly suspect, well, at the people at the Archdiocese asked me if he was touching me, and I said no at the time, but I don't think that's right. I think what happened was that he was touching me while I was sleeping, and that's what caused me to wake up. And the main thing that I've always remembered about that memory was this sense that I had of Father Valentine that I'd never had before, never had again, was just that he was just evil and disgusting. I loved Father Valentine. I thought he was the greatest guy in the world. And the reason this memory stands out is because of the strength of the emotions that I felt during that ride back from the mud cave trip. And I believe that he was touching me, and that's why I woke up. And I believe that's associated with the emotions I felt. And I've talked about that with both of my psychologists, and, you know, one of them called it a flash of insight. And I think that's very much what it was, where at that point, that would be halfway through seventh grade, I was starting to understand that there was something wrong about it. But, well, and to a degree, I believe he had just kind of moved on from me. although he was still touching me at the time. But he would end up leaving Immaculata that summer and move on, I believe, to marry Queen of Peace. But I've always had that memory, and I know I talked about it with in 2002 and then in 2011. I didn't always know what it meant, but I've always remembered it. In terms of other memories, I don't have a whole lot more. I do have an image of a man, of me facing a man's naked chest, a hairy, pale male chest. My eye level is just above the level of the nipples, and I'm just kind of staring into that. And that's an image that would come back to me during intimate moments during my marriage. And it was, I found it to be very confusing, you know, why is this image popping into my head, especially and almost exclusively just, you know, during acts of intimacy. It was very confusing. And I'll get back to that in a minute. So in terms of high school, I was a mess in high school. I was an underachiever, and a lot of that was because I had these weird obsessions and what in retrospect was a lot of behavior that I initially attributed to ADHD, but it was really just kind of my attempt to drown out the memories, where I would watch TV and play music and read all at the same time. And that was the only way that I could kind of relax. And obviously that made studying a problem because, you know, I always had to have like three different things going on at the same time that I was studying, and that made memorizing things very much a problem. And then there was also the fact that I had these obsessions, some of which were of a sexual nature and kind of confusion, but those would take up a lot of time because I would have spent a lot of time trying to fight those. And actually, you know, I've since learned to just kind of give in with them and get them over with, because there's nothing you can do about it, and trying to fight them just prolongs them. But then the really interesting thing is that in the Christmas break of senior year of high school, I ended up going to Haiti with a bunch of other kids on a service project. And the thing that stands out to me the most about that trip was the feeling that I felt and how all the confusion and obsessions and fears and everything just melted away. And here I am in Haiti, the asshole of the Americas, one of the poorest, most terrible places, and I'm just having the time of my life because all these weights that I've been carrying are just gone. They just disappeared. And that's why I have such a positive association with Haiti. But, you know, as soon as I came back to the States, you know, and got back to St. Louis, then everything changed and everything was back. But the contrast between how I felt in St. Louis and how I felt in Haiti and then how I felt in St. Louis again has always stuck with me. Later on during the spring, I had a girlfriend who we started getting serious and started getting intimate. And that's when I realized that I was having some really serious problems associated with intimacy, not sexuality per se, but, you know, I would be touching her and she would be touching me and things would be fine for a while. And then she would touch me in a certain way and it would just destroy me. And I would have a panic attack basically when she would touch me in certain ways. And it just gave me flashbacks and feelbacks to, I didn't understand it at the time, but they were flashbacks and feelbacks to what I felt when Father Valentine was touching me. And those problems continued on into my marriage. I didn't understand what was going on. You know, was I gay? Why did these images pop into my head at certain times, or, you know, when I was touched a certain way, or, and it took me forever to figure it out, but it's very obvious that it's related to how Father Valentine would touch me, and that created problems. And you want to talk about, you know, why do people who've been abused end up getting divorced? Well, because you've got all these negative associations related to something that should be, you know, to to acts and intimacy that should be bringing you closer together. But, you know, in my case, just completely creeping me out. But the interesting thing was that those problems again went away when I went to college in Texas. And I would get off the plane in Texas and all my problems would just melt away. And that was the great thing about Texas was, you know, I was there for 8 or 9 months of the year and I have a huge affinity for Texas. And after I graduated, I ended up moving back there twice. I didn't know if I was going to Texas or trying to go away from St. Louis, but it's obvious in retrospect that I was trying to get away from St. Louis because I just felt different when I was in Texas. And everything was different. You know, I could think, I didn't have feelbacks. I didn't have these weird feelings. I didn't have, you know, intimacy and sexual stuff. It was just a completely different feeling in Texas. But then in 1993, I ended up getting engaged, and we moved back to St. Louis, me for grad school, her for, to pursue, a degree. And very quickly, when I moved back to St. Louis, I ended up having problems with depression that I hadn't had before, particularly when I was in Texas. That's where I learned about cognitive behavioral therapy and was given the book Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, which is a great, really helpful book. And that helped me to a degree, and I ended up getting on some medication, but that caused sexual problems. There were side effects and everything. But it very quickly and very clearly became obvious to me that I was I was allergic to St. Louis. That's a term that I used with my psychologists. And that was confirmed to me when I ended up getting a job in Phoenix, Arizona. And we lived in Phoenix for like a year and a half or so, and then moved back to St. Louis in 1997. And exactly the same thing happened. I was a very different person in Phoenix. I felt very different. I was somewhat obsessive. I wasn't quite as good as I was in Texas. And I would get obsessive about my work because I would kind of escape into my work, much as when I was a kid, I would escape into music and TV and reading. There was a lot of escapism there, and I was dealing with stuff. But Phoenix was a very different feeling. And then moving back to St. Louis in the summer of 1997, especially when we ended up buying a house and kind of settling in, that's when a lot of problems started cropping up, and I started doing this stuff to myself that in retrospect was obviously reenactments of what had happened to me and what had been done to me earlier on. And that's when, a couple of years later, I started figuring things out, and that's when I tried to get help, and that's when the story gets even worse.